Welcome, everyone. This is The LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, November 10th, 2007. This is Veterans Day weekend in the United States. We welcome all of you to listen to the show today. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and I'm the co-editor for economics for the Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And today, the topic we have before us is the financial crash is on now, N-O-W, now, not in the future or pending. It's happening, and this presents the strategic policy crisis that's before the United States, especially, and before the world. And we're very glad to have as guests taking off on discussing this today, who are dealing directly with Washington, D.C., and what the response there is and isn't about our reaction to this crisis. And so I first welcome here in the studio with me the co-editor for economics for EIR, Paul Gallagher. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
And from Washington, D.C., from the LaRouche Youth Movement office there, right in the midst of the action, we're very glad to have Rachel Brown. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you.
And I just want to point up one policy document that Lyndon LaRouche has just written and finished in the last 24 hours. It may already be posted on his Political Action Committee website, which is, it's called Bye-Bye Pelosi, LaRouche Republicans. Is that right, Paul?
Yeah.
And make a point, we'll be discussing some of the leading concepts of that throughout the show in the sense of the crisis we have before us. And that's where we want to begin. That Paul, who's been back and forth to Capitol Hill and otherwise monitoring the empirics of this breathtaking crash, you just wrote an article, Paul, for the Executive Intelligence Review called Mortgage Meltdown Dollar Crash. So what do you want to bring out just to start with?
Well, the dollar collapse has made it frighteningly official, even to many officials, if you know what I mean, that there's a paper crash, a debt crash of financial instruments and financial markets over much of the world, not yet the entire world, but over much of the world, and in particular here in London, in continental Europe, Western Europe. This crash is now a fact. It has happened. The dollar has a lot further to go unless it's stopped. But we're already in the realm in which not only do people lose their homes, as one congresswoman said at the session with Fed Chairman Bernanke the other day, Americans have no idea if they will keep their homes this winter, let alone heat them. The loss of homes by the millions, the loss of jobs, which has already begun in all those areas which are impacted by the housing market, which is a huge chunk, even as a building, even as a construction and building and spending aspect, and the loss of credit, the collapse of credit card debt, and the collapse of banks in which savings, mutual funds, and other deposits of Americans are sitting. That is the process that we're now into. As I said, it was quite clear, probably because the stock market has joined in the plunge in the last few days. It was quite clear on Thursday when Bernanke testified to the Joint Economic Committee that the members of that committee were scared. There was a real sense of dread in what they said. Senator Schumer, in his opening, said, "I fear worse than a recession." Representative Maloney said, "The dollar is sinking like a stone. What is the contingency plan of the Fed?" They see this crash. Now, in March of 2007, in EIR for March 23rd, there was a cover feature which is of great importance still. It was called U.S. Mortgage Collapse Can Cause a Banking Crash. And in 12 pages of charts and graphs, it demonstrated for purposes of readers and policymakers that there was going to be a banking collapse a dollar collapse as a result of what was then being simply called the subprime crisis. That has now come true with a vengeance. And what we're dealing with now, as one of these people who were supposed advisors to the presidential campaigns who were debating yesterday, what we're dealing with now is the extreme timidity of the response on the part of these same frightened elected officials. And that is the force of tragedy, which LaRouche was writing about in the current EIR, the force of the tragic influence on policy of this convergence of Republican neocons with what Nancy Pelosi represents, that part of the Kennedy Democratic machine. This convergence on axioms which seem to prevent them from taking action, axioms such as the pay-as-you-go and fiscal austerity and no tax increases, but above all, this fear of saying anything that appears to be soft on terrorism, soft on immigrants, and so forth. This is producing an extraordinary paralysis, paradoxical, because they're now so frightened of this crash, an extraordinary paralysis, which is the force of tragedy on policy. Fortunately, from the ground up, from the local level, this mobilization that we are spreading on the Homeowner Bank Protection Act is accelerating. We've had four American cities in this week alone, four that I know of, this week alone, who have officially, as cities, called on Congress to pass the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, and that's going to continue.
Let me just switch to Washington there for a minute to Rachel, which is you've been in the halls of Congress also, and maybe even attending some of these kind of financial sessions or whatever. You know, Paul Gallagher just mentioned where Ben Bernanke briefed the Joint Economic Committee. Somebody has called it that's the pot smokers committee. There's a lot of fear there, but there's a lot of craziness. What do you think, Rachel? What do you see in the same way about timidity or fear of going up against Nancy Pelosi, who's putting a lid on what the Democrats will do? What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. That's actually what we've been trying to free these last few weeks, is that fear. Because we had a certain approach in organizing. We have this rotation where we have about 10 or so youth members come into D.C. for about 4 to 6 months or so. So, you know, you come in, you're trying to figure out, like, what the dynamic is. Am I going to change, like, one person in this office and they're going to pass it or whatnot? And so we were having these this approach of sort of doing one-on-one organizing, in a sense, for a couple months or so. We'd set up a lot of meetings with aides in these offices about the HBPA. And we would start to, get through to a couple of them. Some of them would be, you know, so lost on free trade economics that, you know, that they wouldn't even be close to acting on this idea. But a few of them, we might get to become close to acting on the idea. There are a few reasonable people in there. But then the question is, well, what keeps them from acting on it once they do make the discovery, if they do? You know, say this is an aid. So then they go to their congressman, maybe, and they say, hey, congressman, you know, what about LaRouche's idea? This is a pretty cool idea. You know, I think it would actually work. Well, the congressman then, what do they have to deal with? They have to deal with the dynamics of the committee that they're in. You know, if you look at the Financial Services Committee, they really haven't fought against the hedge funds in the way that they should. Or they have the peer group of their other congressmen. What will they say if I go against the leadership? You know, what will Pelosi do if I go against her? You know, who will she unleash on me? But the real question is, as Paul was bringing up, is this real? Like, this is the idea of tragedy. What will happen if they go against Pelosi? Well, really, something good would happen. and the only thing that they really have to be afraid of in terms of Pelosi is, well, okay, she represents Dick Cheney and the financial establishment. Well, what's happening in the financial establishment right now? It's finished. So if they're going along with this irrational fear of Pelosi, they themselves are making themselves a part of the collapse of the system. They're condemning themselves and their own disaster by not acting against this. So that's something that we've been conscious in trying to assault and bring out, is ridicule Pelosi out of power. And we've definitely started already seeing effects of this. I know over the last week or so that Pelosi has been sending out emails and making statements around the country saying, you know, that over this last year, the Democrats have been doing great things, you know. And you can tell that she's definitely already on the defensive just from this, basically just from about a week of us going after this.
And just could you describe for people, too? I think you have a banner that's become very famous. I've seen it on the websites. Could you just say what it looks like or how big it is?
Yeah, sure. It's pretty big. We make them out of shower curtains. So it's a big shower curtain size, and it's got a huge blown-up picture of Pelosi's face, and it has screws coming out of the side of it. Because the question with Pelosi has been, maybe it's been the pain that she had from her facelift has been keeping her under this tension and keeping her from being, you know, being able to loosen up. So we just wanted to let people know that it wasn't necessarily her fault, but, you know, maybe if we got a screwdriver, we could help her out. And so we've got that picture, and then the words on the banner say, congressional approval rate, 70% to 10.7%. Are you tired of being screwed? Fire misleadership.
So that must have been a big hit some places, though, right?
Yeah. We've been taking this out at the Metro where Congress enters the Capitol South. So they walk by this banner Monday morning, and we're just getting great, great reactions. Some people were doing thumbs up. Some people were, you know, trying to put their heads down, but were obviously very affected by it.
Well, if we can go back and forth on this just for 1 minute. Paul, you mentioned just this very week four cities, and I know a couple of them, Gary, Indiana, Pomona, California, Jackson, Mississippi, and, Newcastle, Western Pennsylvania. Voted up resolutions that Congress should take emergency action along the lines of the LaRouche Political Action Committee, the Homeowners Bank and Protection Act. But take Gary, Indiana. I know you looked at the text of that. I want to make a call here for people to get these. These are being posted by the LaRouche Political Action Committee for the mobilization. For anyone who may be listening live now or later by telephone or by archive website, that this kind of thing, given the reality, if you're not blocked and worried about your peer pressure and everything else, that it can go out and get it passed, get organizing for it in your locality and feed the pressure. But the kind of thing Gary, Indiana, which has over 100,000 people, use that as an example.
First of all, it's important to stress that no one, and this may seem incredible, but with now, you know, you pick up any newspaper any day or listen to any news program, you hear that 2, 3, or 4 million American households are about to lose their homes over the next 12 months. And yet, despite the fact that everyone knows that, and it's the number one economic problem on the agenda of both political parties, no one in Congress has yet proposed, no one other than LaRouche PAC has yet proposed legislation to stop foreclosures. And they acknowledge this. One congressman in a press conference this week put it this way. He said, this is the element we haven't gotten to yet, keeping people in their homes. Now, that's incredible. With proposals floating all over the place for various arcane ways to stop the next crash, no one has yet, and they acknowledge, they haven't yet gotten to keeping people in their homes. That should give you an idea of why there is so much fire underneath the LaRouche PAC and LaRouche Youth Movement mobilization for the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. We're not nursing cities with this. We had a couple of calls with the officials in the city of Gary, Indiana. They then went ahead and ran with this, and the city council voted up a call on Congress. And it says, whereas a financial crisis involving home mortgages, debt instruments, and the United States banking system threatens economic stability and threatens the integrity of federal and chartered banks, where the consumer deposits and life savings are jeopardized, and whereas historically the federal government has intervened to protect financial institutions and home ownership and to provide guarantees of social and economic stability. They put the nail right on the head. We can't let banks close down chartered, depository institutions, what LaRouche calls regular banks, as opposed to the savings, investment banks and the hedge funds and so on. We can't let them close down. We can't let millions of households be thrown out in the street. And yet the force of this, in part, is the amazing fact that no one in Congress has even proposed, let alone any committee having enacted or anything. No one has proposed yet to stop these foreclosures.
Right. We have on the dynamic in Congress, let me put to both of you, Paul and Rachel, an email from the Oakland area of California from James, who asks, would you comment on the significance of the first veto of the Bush-Cheney administration override, first override of the veto of Bush that happened in this administration? You know, that was on the Water Resources and Development Act, and the Senate overrode the veto 79-14 this week. But James asked, Mrs. Pelosi seems almost happy about that. Do you have any insights as to whether that would signify she's mobilizing in Congress to start moving? Paul?
Well, the Water Resources Development Act, by overwhelming bipartisan consensus to pass this act, already goes back more than 2 years. And what's new here was not the overwhelming veto-proof majorities in both houses. What's new here is the just outright insanity of the Cheney-ac advisors to President Bush to tell him to veto the thing on the grounds that it's a form of the immigrant bashing, fear mongering that is really all that Cheney and Bush do, fear of higher taxes, so on and so forth. It's stupid in the extreme. But that's the new element, is that Bush, against all reason, decided to veto this, knowing that it would be overridden, and it was. And that certainly is a welcome defeat for Cheney and Bush on this front. It doesn't. Well, we may see another one in the case of Amtrak spending and Amtrak investment. That would also be welcome, but it doesn't indicate any shift in what's happening in the Congress, really, because, as I say, these overwhelming bipartisan majorities existed already 2 years ago for
right.
For these actions, and in particular for the Upper Mississippi Locks and Dam replacement, which is 30 years overdue.
Right. Well, Rachel, to carry on this, let me just ask one thing, because speaking of, going against the Cheney-Bush administration outright, you were right there on the scene when Representative Kucinich brought as a point of privilege this week his resolution that we should impeach Cheney. Can you go into that some?
Yeah. You mean how the vote occurred or the response?
Or any of that in the sense of the signifying here at least some, in other words, this is a live question, despite the grip that the Pelosi has on it. You know, you did have this signs of life out of Congress.
Okay, yeah. Well, that was pretty interesting to me, because I'll just tell the truth that the week before when I found out that Kucinich was going to do this, and of course our plan was to emphasize this in Congress and to use it as something of a flank on the Pelosi question of, Pelosi said that we should take impeachment off the table, but she is what's brought the congressional approval rating from 70% to 10.7% in a year. So, you know, maybe it's time to go with Kucinich on this. It's time to impeach Cheney, because you can't get anything good done in the country unless you do get rid of him. So that was our approach the week of, is to just sort of bring that message to Congress and, you know, see what comes out of it. But I honestly wasn't optimistic in terms of the Democrats doing anything on it. So, you know, we our idea was to target some of the committees. We went to the Out of Iraq Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus and the Progressive Caucus, people that had various signers already of Kucinich's resolution. So we went to these offices, and what they told us was that they were getting just tons of calls on it. And so, you know, I was like, wow, that's great, you know. That's good. The population is moving. The population isn't asleep. They haven't given up on getting rid of Cheney. So that happened. And then we go to the vote that day, and you get this crazy phenomenon where the Republicans start changing their votes. You know, it started out, it looked like, you know, there was a few Democrats voting to not to table it and to have a discussion on it, but a lot of Democrats are voting to table it. And then suddenly you had this change throughout, which, you know, maybe people know from reading the reports on the news or whatnot. But the Republicans told the Republican leadership told the Republicans to start changing their votes. And the way that they expressed in the press about the why they did this, maybe Paul knows more, I'm kind of confused about it myself, is that they wanted to force the Democrats to a debate. So the vote, you know, the vote went through, and the significant thing that Lynn pointed out about it is that 86 Democrats in the first vote voted not to table the resolution, directly, you know, opposing the orders of Steny Hoyer, who is speaking on behalf of Pelosi, who said impeachment is not on our agenda. So from the beginning, even without this whole, you know, Republican charade or, you know, tool tactic, I guess, that occurred, the Democrats, 86 Democrats, did openly oppose Pelosi's leadership on this. So after that, you know, it went to committee. And now the question is, what's going to happen under Conyers' watch? So we actually did some organizing the next day in the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if you want to hear about that right now.
Yeah, I mean, in other words, yeah, I do.
Okay. So the next day we go to the Judiciary Committee offices. Again, you know, the Judiciary Committee that night, the night of the vote, had put out a statement saying, well, this is, you know, interesting that this occurred, but we've got FISA and we've got, you know, problems with other things the administration has done that are already on our agenda, and we're just not sure whether we're going to respond to this impeachment resolution immediately. That was the statement Wednesday night. Again, something of a pessimistic, oh, are they going to play the same old game? So we go into the Judiciary Committee to bring them a response that LaRouche wrote to Steny Hoyer. And what Steny Hoyer said after the vote, he said, Speaker Pelosi and I have made it clear that this Congress is not going to proceed with impeachment and is going to focus on critical issues facing our nation, such as health care for children and the war in Iraq. And so this is LaRouche's response to Steny Hoyer that we were getting out in the Judiciary Committee. He says, respectfully, your office's message misses the crucial points. The ouster of Vice President Cheney is an existential issue of immediately highest importance for the continued existence of our republic. Failure to oust Cheney now would represent the gravest, clear, and present danger to the continued existence of our present constitutional republic. The only legislative issue of comparable importance for our republic is the immediate enactment of my proposed firewall legislation, HBPA, without which a social crisis combined with chain reaction disintegration of our banking system are virtually inevitable for the short period immediately ahead. The speaker may have a contrary agenda, but that agenda is not presently in the existential interest of our republic. Political egos cannot be given priority over the existential interests of our republic and its people. So we're getting that statement out, and again, we get the response in these offices that the secretaries are telling us that they're getting so many calls on the impeachment resolution that they can't get any work done.
Well, I went into, on Friday afternoon, I went into one of the offices of the Judiciary Committee for a meeting about the HPPA. But while we were waiting momentarily outside, the aide there got a call, and he listened, and he said, "So you would support the committee moving articles of impeachment on Dick Cheney? I'll pass it along." He hung up, and he said, "All day long, all day long. That's all we're getting, impeach Cheney." So I asked him if they were getting any more from other members of the Congress. And he said, well, the few, they've been publicized, but if there are a few more, I think something will happen. But, of course, we've heard that before. What Rachel was saying, this fear factor. I think the Republicans played this game that started evidently with John Shattuck of Arizona. They played this game because they thought that there were no Democrats prepared to present and argue the impeachment of Cheney, there was an unusual number of Democrats who voted against the tabling motion. In other words, yes, let's see this on the floor now, let's debate it. The Republicans didn't expect that to happen because they thought that this was bluff and that because of Pelosi's misleadership that no one was actually prepared to speak for the impeachment of Cheney. Kucinich himself was asked the next morning. He said, "I had three binders full of arguments ready to go. I was prepared to impeach him right then and there." So evidently he also had other, there were also others who were ready to back him and join in that.
And I understand from a briefing this morning that Mr. Representative Kucinich has sent a letter to the chairman of the committee, Representative Conyers, just updating more grounds for impeachment in the sense that Cheney has been caught in the act of trying to influence the national intelligence estimate of Iran to make it grounds for waging war on Iran. So this is of course, it's a good thing for Kucinich to do, but it certainly also shows the danger of the attack actually being made, having these Cheneyaks remain in power. Do you have more on that, Rachel, or we can continue? No?
You can continue.
Because, Paul, let me ask you this, because you were stressing again the way reality is hitting of these millions of people that, you know, the timing of the resets of the adjustable rate mortgages or various other aspects of this. Let me ask you a twofold question. You can address it, both of it, or separately. One manifestation of the crisis is the amount of publicly acknowledged write-downs of assets of big name and other smaller banks, right? That's been happening right now. And then secondly, what do you see as the upcoming timing of still more, of the actual mortgage blowout in the way of what's been built in with these crazy things over the last several years of this Greenspan bubble of these, you know, knowingly creating impossible to pay mortgages?
Well, we know that the size of the bubble was so huge and so unprecedented that the whole world's banking system and all the hedge funds dove into it. Investment funds of all kinds from all over the world dove into it. It reached, in a matter of 5 years, the issuance of $20 trillion worth of new mortgage originations, mortgage-backed securities, collateralized debt obligations, which buy and hold these mortgage-backed securities. A $20 trillion bubble appeared within 5 years. Now, that doesn't happen without every bank in the world being compromised. And that includes banks like the People's Bank of China, which holds well over 100, maybe $200 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. And, of course, it goes to all of those funds, hedge funds and private equity funds who bought the securities from the investment banks and then created these derivatives, these special investment vehicles, these collateralized debt obligations. They then went into the commercial paper market, especially these so-called special investment vehicles. They went and borrowed the money to buy the mortgage-backed securities in the commercial paper market. That has now ruined the commercial paper market as a result. So when $20 trillion is going down, these are half of the assets of the entire United States banking system, and they're all going down. Now, this is part of the pressure and the fear that it's causing in Congress in terms of action. These banks, by their own petty estimates, because they're lying their heads off about it, the big international banks and the investment banks, they themselves say that they are losing $64 billion in the fourth quarter in write-offs after having lost about $40 billion in the third quarter. One more adventurous estimate comes from Royal Bank of Scotland. They say that all these big banks and hedge funds are going to lose $500 billion during the course of the next two quarters in write-offs of these mortgage-backed securities and so forth. This is all nonsense. It's $20 trillion that these banks are in the process of writing off and that these hedge funds are in the process of losing. So they are, in turn, putting all kinds of pressure on individual members of Congress, and we felt this very strongly in talking to staffs and committee aides and so forth. They're terrified that the banking community is coming after them, that they're bribing certain members of Congress, particularly the hedge funds and the private equity funds, are bribing people like Chuck Schumer, Senator Chuck Schumer, to oppose any action. The banks are threatening that the slightest move to interfere with the foreclosure process in a legal way, in a legislative way, or even, they say, by allowing bankruptcy judges to do it, would cause a catastrophe, and therefore to even speak of such things will tend to cause panic and massive further losses and so forth. They hope, they think they have members of Congress over a barrel with this kind of, with the fear of these kind of consequences. It's funny, if you go back to 1933 when FDR did the bank holiday, in the days before he took office and closed the banks and enacted the bank holiday, all the bank spokesmen were demanding that he do nothing. They were opposing anything he might do and saying that anything he did would be disastrous. In the weeks after the bank holiday, they all liked it. So, we're getting, in a certain sense, the panic of the banks being brought to bear and creating panic among members of Congress, where even the tiniest little steps, nothing to do with the Halla Motors and Bank Protection Act, which would actually stop the foreclosures, but even the smallest little steps, they fear the reaction of the banking community because the banks are going under.
Well, let me ask you further, Paul, if you would just characterize, you've written about this, we've had this on recent shows, but the kind of non-action that's presented as action that you're pointing out here is especially Barney Frank in that bill, right? Because this is what a lot of people around the country, if you call up a congressman and say, we want action, and I'll say, they support the Frank bill. But would you say what that is and isn't?
Well, the main thing it is it's dead. Again, a lot of proposals have been made in Congress. Some have passed the House. But those that have nothing to do with all the people being foreclosed. They have to do with the next mortgage bubble. Should the U.S. economy survive to have another one, these things that they've passed the House will prevent it from getting as bad as this one. They acknowledge that it has nothing to do with keeping people in their homes now. The one thing that Barney Frank and the Senate side, Chuck Schumer, have proposed has gotten no co-sponsors in either House. The reason is what they're saying is let's increase the capital of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two big federal mortgage companies, by a combined total of about $150 billion. Let's let them go out into the bond market, borrow another $150 billion, and put at least $125 billion of it into buying subprime mortgages at risk of foreclosure and refinancing those mortgages. Now, not only are Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac not in a position to do that, they are actually shrinking. Both of them themselves are taking losses from the shrinking value of mortgages as the price of homes drops in the United States. So rather than needing a higher capital limit in order to get more funds and invest, they're actually shrinking in their total assets because of losses that they themselves are taking. And yesterday, I think it was, Fannie Mae reported a $1.5-something billion loss in the third quarter because of the declining value of homes and mortgages. So it's been quite realized now across the board that they can't do this, that you could ruin Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and put them into bankruptcy if you tried to make them swallow all this toxic mortgage crap and refinance it. And therefore, they just have to stay out of that. So there are no co-sponsors, either in the House or the Senate, for this idea. It's going nowhere. There is only one way to stop the foreclosures, and that's to pass a law that stops the foreclosures, which is what the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act does. And it does so by protecting the banks to the extent necessary, the depository banks, against the huge losses that they're taking, so that they can remain open, keep taking deposits, keep making loans. It's the only proposal that would do either of those things.
And let me just ask right here, either Rachel or Paul, could you just recount in the last 10 days to 2 weeks, then you did have acknowledgement of this publicly, like Representative Conyers reading. Could you mention about that? Were you there, Rachel, at that hearing where Representative Conyers read from some of the text of the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act or not?
No, I wasn't.
Rochelle Asher was there, but this was one of several hearings the same week, not this week ending, but the week before that, in which lawmakers brought up the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act and asked witnesses what they thought of it, another way, in a certain way of bringing it up, discussing, but ducking the responsibility for it. They asked the witnesses what they thought of it. That was Conyers in a hearing of a subcommittee of the judiciary who did that 2 weeks ago this coming Tuesday. And then that Thursday in the Financial Services Committee of the House, Al Green of Texas and also Gwen Moore of Wisconsin raised the same questions to witnesses. People are asking us to stop all foreclosures by law. Should we do that? So it's now reached that point, and what they meant by people is cities like Gary and Pomona. In Conyers' case, he meant 21 members of the Michigan State Legislature who've asked him to do that. That fire is growing.
Right. One thing, unless Rachel wants to add something about the scene on Capitol Hill and this dynamic, let me just, Paul, you talked about the home mortgages, everything pyramided on top of that being having to be written down. It's blowing out. But then you get the kind of H-bomb of the financial system, these crazy things called structured investment vehicles. I mean, just in general, these were some of the big banks' creative accounting that did these kind of offshore wild investment entities, let's call it. And this is another aspect of what's actually blowing out right now.
Our colleague Richard Freeman is doing a major job on them for the next issue of EIR, not this week's but next week's, because of the astonishing similarity to what Enron did in these structured investment vehicles, except that they are orders of magnitude bigger than anything that Enron had out there floating. And they are now bringing down banks. The structured investment vehicles were off-balance book investment funds that the banks sponsored. They didn't actually put their own money into them, but they sponsored them, and they gave them credit backing, that is, in effect, credit guarantees, in case anything should go wrong. That way they wouldn't have to have them on their books, and they wouldn't have to have core capital, reserve capital to underlie them. But they controlled them in every degree, and they had these structured investment vehicles borrow money from the commercial paper market where they could borrow because of the Greenspan, Bernanke helicopter money policy. They could borrow in that market at 3 or 4%. And then they would, with that short-term borrowed money, they would buy mortgage-backed securities, typically, or similar things that would pay them 8 or 9 or 10%, depending on what tranches they bought. But those were long-term. So they were borrowing for 30 or 60 days and rolling it over and rolling it over in order to get a much higher interest rate for 2 years or 5 years. At a certain point, the rollover stopped happening because the mortgage-backed securities value was exposed, beginning with the Bear Stearns debacle in June and July. The value of what they were buying was exposed as being only on paper, only in the bank's computer programs, not really on the market at all. Then they couldn't refinance the commercial paper that they had used to raise the money, and so they ruined the commercial paper market in the process, and it's been shrinking ever since. And now these banks are trying to get various super vehicles or groups of hedge funds to buy these debts off their hands at 20 or 30 or 40 cents on the dollar, which itself is illegal. And in fact, Merrill Lynch now is the first one being investigated by the Securities and Exchange Commission for doing exactly, precisely what Enron did with its off-balance sheet. And once Enron was exposed on those, Enron vaporized. And that is the situation that Merrill Lynch and probably Citibank are in right now.
Hence, a former Treasury Department official in charge of Citicorps, as you might call it, for a temporary period of time. I mean, to, in particular, Bob Rubin, maybe to cast some authority over. Otherwise, it's a complete blowout, right?
Yeah, to bring in some, group of some gang of real big, deep-pocketed suckers from the financial community to try to keep these dead banks going a little bit longer. But as a matter of the general welfare of our nation, for many of these banks, we have to protect them. Again, we're not talking about investment banks, but the depository banks, which have many, many hundreds of billions of dollars of American savings in them and other kinds of various kinds of savings and fund deposits, we have to protect those banks. If some of the big ones go down, as one congressman said to me, what he was afraid of is if one or two of these really big banks actually go under, close their doors, they'll take hundreds and hundreds of little banks with them all over the country. So there has to be protection, and it has to be targeted to those depository or regular banking institutions.
Right. And in fact, well, let me ask you, Rachel, too. Have you been involved in trying to, let's call it high-level channeling of some of the expressions of demand from localities in Massachusetts or other places, fed right into Congress to up the heat on trying to give them some backbone and some fear if they aren't evil, you know, if their response, is that the kind of thing you've been doing?
Yeah. One thing we did is that we did get a call into the Boston office from a woman who was losing her house. And she had been lied to on the papers in terms of in terms of her case, I don't remember exactly what it was. I know that there's been a number of cases where the people had their income lied about on the papers or in order that they could get loans that they couldn't actually pay for. And in her case, I don't remember exactly what the conditions were. But she didn't know who to turn to, so she did call our office in Boston, and they turned her case over to us to use as leverage for Congress to say, look, you know, at what's happening here in your district. Look at what's happening to just one individual and how many times that's magnified.
And, Paul, Some of what's been happening at this, what you just described, you can take eastern Pennsylvania, right, where you had 800 people lied to by a particular kind of Lancaster County region, which blew up over their mortgages. And they had hidden, I think, phantom mortgages and everything foisted on them. But that's also an area where this is one of the – how many states are there now that has a resolution before in the state capitol? About eight states.
Seven. Yeah, I think it's seven.
Seven states now, in the Homeowners and Bank Protection Act. But among the congressmen in Washington, one of them, Representative Kanjorski, who's north of there, he's in the I guess the Wilkes-Barre region, but he has been speaking out on the condition of the financial system, right?
Well, he and also at least one or two of the Republicans on that committee, when the proposal to use Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as the big fish to swallow all the toxic junk and refinancing, he raised an alarm about that, and so did one or two of the Republicans on that committee, as I mentioned, that in the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s, we had the result that good banks and bad banks all went down together, and the entire saving and loan sector literally disappeared overnight in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana. In that whole region of the country, within a couple of years, there were no savings and loans left. They persisted in other parts of the country, but that was because you had a situation of falling home prices and tremendous pressure to foreclose and throw people out of their homes. And every bank was enveloped by it. Every bank was pushed into foreclosing on people, and it did them no good, and they wound up being liquidated anyway. So a number of congressmen from that area have raised the same alarm, and it simply means that they're registering the fact that, look, we don't just have to protect the homeowners from foreclosure. And remember, we're not doing that. we have to do that. We don't just have to do that. We also have to protect the banks from being forced into closing down because of just the scale of the losses they're taking in delinquent mortgages and mortgage securities.
Right. I'll just interject here. Robert, also from the Oakland, California area, that's getting us near Pelosi's district, of course, need I say. Mm-hmm. But he sent in a couple questions. Robert, one of them, I think Paul and Rachel already answered. He was asking about the dynamic, why Republicans might have voted not to table Kucinich's resolution for impeachment. I think Paul answered that. They thought they might put the Democrats on the spot and smear them if they had to debate this, which wasn't the case. But
They thought they would. They would show them up because they wouldn't come out and say anything.
Okay.
They wouldn't actually come out and start impeaching the bastard on the spot, which is what the resolution implied.
But Robert also asks, apropos the discussion, how are these representatives and senators sleeping at night? Do they have any idea where they are going and what they're going to do for this blowout, which, of course, has been our topic all the way through? But the Congress is still in session, right? It's going to be so, except for the Thanksgiving break. And do you know, either Rachel or Paul, is there some particular point on Capitol Hill that is a certain kind of turning point, or it's a question of intensifying mobilization everywhere right now?
Rachel, what do you think?
Question as to whether there's a turning point.
Or one event or one. Are you looking to any, you know, in the upcoming weeks, is there some particular occasion? There's not a committee hearing or something, right? It's a question of a process of forcing reality in Congress?
Yeah, I think in terms of the reflections we've had from Conyers and from Al Green, and I heard that recently Nick Lampson, also from Texas, actually Tom DeLay's seat, which we essentially got him his seat in that way, has, through a dialogue with us, recently come out speaking about the idea of a capital budget, which, of course, is LaRouche's proposal to create a long-term funding mechanism for large-scale economic projects. So you are just seeing things come out as the crisis worsens, And the point that Lynn just made, you know, a couple days ago, which we started with, is that the system is not collapsing. It's not like we're waiting for the moment to collapse, but the system has collapsed. And I just want to give a fun metaphor because he used it in his paper and it's fun. So he says that the system was like a planet, you know, going through its orbit. And, well, similar to what we know about the asteroid belt, the theory that it's actually an exploded planet because it's an unstable orbit. Well, the system that is a planet reached a point of instability earlier this week, and so now it's not even it's not together. It's actually it is now pieces. What we are seeing right now is not the system. All we are seeing is parts of the system that's actually already exploded. So that's the context of which the congressmen are acting in. And as we were getting these just massive amounts of calls into the offices this week, that's what the congressmen are dealing with. They actually are dealing with right now inundations of calls from their constituencies, whether it's on impeachment or losing their house or losing their jobs. And that's a period where people can change. And I think people are changing. And I think the fact of what we saw this week in terms of the vote around this Kucinich resolution or some of the responses on the HBPA is that there is something in human nature which is good and which actually is responding to the organizing we're doing, the organizing of the population and its effect on Congress and the dynamic we're creating in the country. So I think that we don't know, and there's not one particular thing, but we can be optimistic in terms of what we've seen recently to the chances of some good things happening.
I just want to direct something to Robert Hill, who sent in this question. The turning point, and I think his question implied more, and it was a useful one, the turning point is us. The turning point is LPAC. If LaRouche PAC were to go through a dramatic expansion in its ability to field organizers, young people, for the LIM to recruit more young people and support them in organizing, and get these, if you and others get local elected bodies to come out for the HBPA, that's the turning point because we are the presidency. And the Congress, I think, are not sleeping at night. They do too much sleeping during the day, but I think they're not sleeping at night. I think if you watch that hearing of the Joint Economic Committee with Bernanke, you could see that they were scared, they were angry, they were even, some of them, desperate. They were yelling at Bernanke, you got this all wrong, you said this was contained, clearly you were wrong. Some were more polite than others. Some yelled at him. You know, they read foreclosure statistics to him. It was a very upset group of congressmen and senators. But if you talk to anybody about what we're doing, they say, look, FDR did this. FDR was the president, not the Congress. You know, obviously something is missing here. There's no presidency in what we're fighting for. Because you've got Cheney, you've got Bush, you've got Cheney who's got to be removed because he's a psychopath, and you've got Bush who's just pathetic. So there's no presidency involved. All of the 100 days legislation that was passed to start to turn the Depression around was proposed to the Congress by Franklin Roosevelt. It didn't come out of the Congress, although he had discussed it for years earlier with certain key members of the Congress. As president, he proposed it. Now we're the presidency. When LaRouche has run for the president in the past, it has been as much to form the presidency, reshape the presidency, as it has been to get elected president himself. Because the presidency is an institution through which the president, the vice president, can act. In this case, it's clearly us. So we have to do a great deal more in order to move a Congress in the way that a President Franklin Roosevelt could move that Congress. The turning point will really be our expansion in membership, in finances, in the number of elected officials. We turn to this on the local level because we said from the beginning, this is going to come from the base and it's going to be on the state level, burn the Congress. That is what's missing. It's not a level of anxiety on the part of the Congress and their staffs that's missing. We can all see that when we go in there.
Right, thanks. And let me underscore that to people in California who are emailing in, look on the LaRouche PAC website, the Political Action Committee, www.larouchepac.com, for this new document called Bye Bye Pelosi, LaRouche Republicans. And in LaRouche's own words, what he is committed to do, what Paul was just describing, he said, in this present instance, my required role is to define that necessary framework needed to transform the elected executive. He's talking about the whole election process for a presidency that's going to function. The presidency used by our republic to successfully implement the policy that we need for the country. And he, again, to use his own words, he said, this is to be seen as the curative application of insight into the classical principle of tragedy that's now gripping our nation. So LaRouche, as some of you know who are participating, goes way back. I remember 1976 when Paul Gallagher's wife, and I happened to have the honor of being the chairman of LaRouche's election committee that year, and Anita Gallagher mm-hmm. was the right-hand person. LaRouche was on the ballot in 26 states. He's run for the presidency for the office of president many times on policy. Now he's running in the same way for the policy of the presidency, and the resources are needed. And I want to mention one thing in particular, and then see if Rachel has any comment. The youth, the LaRouche youth movement, who are transforming transforming the situation now is a continuing process of transformation, as they did with the November 2006 elections, the youth factor. They are producing a pamphlet in the next week. It's going to bed the next couple of days to help spring or to help expose and lift this grip of mind control by all the kind of virtual reality operations being done against youth in the form of Facebook, MySpace, you name it. And the resources are needed to get that out in the millions, if possible, hundreds of thousands, and to get it out fast. Do you want to say anything about that, Rachel, in the way that will help contribute to this transformation process?
The transformation.
I mean of unleashing people to respond to reality instead of being stuck.
Okay. One thing I was thinking about it in terms of the presidential campaign, as the point was made, Lynn's not running for president this year. And he's been saying, well, look, this legislation, you can think of this as a presidential campaign, as a presidential action. As Paul brought up, what we're doing right now is to shape whatever candidate comes in, you know, what decisions they make, what they're held accountable for, what they're inspired by, is going to be shaped by us. Okay, so, you know, so what have these presidential candidates done so far? You know, several of them even announced their presidencies on the internet. You know, even Kucinich right here has about 30 entries on MySpace himself. So this is definitely a delusional factor that could, if not combated, majorly could destroy this next presidential election in terms of how people are looking at it, how they're thinking about their candidate. You know, do they appeal to my issues? This the same way that people are thinking when they're in this MySpace fantasy. It has nothing to do with reason or reality. But simply, what are their feelings? What colors do they like? What's their what's their chosen identity?
Their diet, right?
Yeah. You know, whether they like tofu or beef. You know,
favorite park bench. This is my space.
Right. Well, we're down now to only a few seconds. I was going to ask Paul about the one aspect of the state revenues are blowing out. That's another reality factor that's affecting people.
Well, we have it here, $100 million in this county out of $1.5 billion.
That's Loudoun County, Virginia,
missing.
Folks.
Loudoun County, ground zero of the housing bubble.
Well, with that, it does seem the clock has run out. But on the other hand, we know where we're going ahead. And so I thank everyone. This has been November 10th, 2007, The LaRouche Show. We're weekly from 3 to 4 Eastern Time. And I thank Rachel Brown, Paul Gallagher. And next week, for certain, please tune in at the same time, live on the Internet. That's November 17th. Thank you all very much.